Kia ora, hello comrades. The following talks were given as contributions to the annual conference of Fight Back Australasia. First, we have Jade Saab speaking on the Lebanese Revolution and associated uprisings in the Middle East and West Asia. Then Rocio Lopez on the US and Latin American social movements. So firstly, Jade Saab is a Lebanese-Canadian writer and activist currently finishing a PhD at the University of Glasgow on ideology and the process of socialist revolution. He has recently edited A Region in Revolt, a collection of five essays on the latest uprisings in Sudan, Algeria, Lebanon, Iran, and Iraq. He's also a regional organizer with the Industrial Workers of the World. Since 2018, North Africa and West Asia have been passing through a second revolutionary window after the first Arab Spring. This talk will discuss the differences and similarities between the two processes, key lessons to take away, and the importance of regional and international solidarity with working class movements away from simplistic geopolitical stances. Unfortunately, the start of this talk was cut off, so it starts midstream. That was my bad. And there are also some glitches in the recording, which was recorded over the video conference. So apologies about that, but I hope you enjoy the talk.
Radical changes in social relations, in women's rights, in minorities' rights, and sexual liberation, all of these play a very important role. And in many of the protests, we've seen women take the front lines as well. So these struggles have resulted in revolutionary situations in all of these countries, but it remains unclear if they will lead to revolutionary outcomes. It's still an ongoing and unfolding process. This largely depends, you know, whether or not there are revolutionary outcomes, on whether or not the movements themselves can work through some of their own contradictions and evolve past of their organizational limitations. I'll discuss that in a bit. So some common characteristics that these movements have is they all have negative demands. They're all arguing against something. The rejection of the various clannish oligarchies and military dictatorships that run their countries. None of them have defined positive political programs. So they've not yet been able to combine their demands and create a positive kind of program of what needs to be done. In simple ways, they know what they don't want, but they don't know what yet how to progress beyond that. This tactic, though, if it's right to call it a tactic, it's not entirely voluntary. Most of these countries share in the fact that these forces of resistance that we're seeing today have previously been crushed. That's how the state power has been able to maintain power. So these mass movements are missing the strong labor movements or oppositional political parties that usually carry such movements and unify these demands. So the structures of resistance that we're seeing today, they represent either shells of previous structures, remnants of what was available before, or new and therefore underdeveloped structures of resistance. In certain countries, though, leaderlessness has been espoused in a strength, and there is some truth of this. For example, in Lebanon, the slogan of the people do not negotiate, they demand. It reflected kind of the rejection of having the movement enter the fold when the government made overtures towards, you know, having willingness to negotiate. So in a way, it has safeguarded these movements from being co-opted. And it's also protected a lot of these leaders from the oppressive reach of the government. But it is clear, however, that no matter what positive attributes this leaderlessness provides, it's not enough, and what is emerging in the form, and something more needs to emerge in the form of organization. There is also promising development. Sudan, for example, is the only country in which a coalition has been able to emerge and come to a power-sharing agreement with the military there. The coalition itself is changing, but it represents a wide array of the population, from trade unionists to, at one point, the Communist Party. The coalition, as I said, continues to change. It is quite loose. It's called the Forces of Freedom and Change. And it was set up by the Sudanese Professional Associations, which is a trade union, an illegal trade union organization that was kind of organizing illicitly. This has led many commentators in the region to kind of take up workplace organizing as the only tool that can promise salvation. But it's a bit mistaken on two counts. First, the SPA, the Sudanese Professional Association, has been around for several years in Sudan. So you can't really find parallels in other countries where such an organization existed to really lead the charge. And second, focusing entirely on labor has turned a blind eye on a second really important force in Sudan, which are called the resistance committees. And these are very also loose grassroots groups. They helped organize protest actions and mutual aid, especially now in the time of COVID. And they did this on a neighborhood by neighborhood basis. They were quite spontaneous. They emerged. And even when the SPA kind of faced a lot of media oppression, the internet was shut down in the country, they started playing a much more important leading role. And now that the FFC are in government, it's these resistant committees that can ensure a full transition takes place. So they have become the kind of the forces that hold the revolutionary forces themselves accountable. And these sorts of grassroots committees, they've emerged in other uprisings as well. Mainly we've seen them in Iraq and Lebanon, although there they were unable to coordinate and they continue to remain fragmented and politically diverse. But I maintain, as well as many of my co-writers, that it is these forms of grassroots organizing that we need to look to, and we need to hope that they will solidify and develop kind of the sharp focus that was given to them in Sudan by the FFC, but develop this capacity themselves. And it's by them crystallizing that we can see a promising reemergence of the mass movement in the same intensity that it was present before COVID. So the final point I want to discuss here is the importance of solidarity. The most common kind of barrier for any of these countries achieving their goals is debilitating national debt. And obviously, these national debts, while we can take them on a nation by nation basis, we need to see how they plug into the global capitalist system. These debts also mean that foreign finance have a vested interest in maintaining quote-unquote stability in the region. This has been made very clear in the case such as Tunisia, where even though they have been able to change the system and enter a more democratic system, they've still not been able to kind of rid themselves of these economic, what I'm calling balancing the book kind of idea. We do see some promising development in these movements that they are aware of these challenges, that even if they are able to get rid of these despotic regimes or the suppressive regimes, that they will need to go beyond that. And we've seen some forms of solidarity develop, a big chant in Lebanon and in Iraq, for example, where chants in support of the uprisings happening in other countries. This is obviously a promising development. The region is quite fragmented as it was designed colonially, but it's good to see these notes, these kind of hints of solidarity emerging, but nothing concrete really has come out. Right, so and what this involves, to develop the solidarity, it also involves working through the many dimensions of oppression in the region that are found between these countries. The topics I've already mentioned, refugees, the existence of regional imperialism, migrant labor that translates into racism between different countries. These are things that get in the way of regional solidarity, and the movements themselves need to work through these issues as they develop and as they grow, so that they can then confront global capitalism as a region and not just as these fragmented countries, which, as we see in the case of Sudan, for example, is being pushed towards actually agreeing with imperialist goals in the region, such as normalizing relations with Israel, in the hopes that this will bring them some kind of financial reprieve from the debts they hold. Final point worth discussing very quickly is the role of international solidarity, or as I like to say, the lack of it. Unfortunately, some socialist groups especially still seem to be under the influence of Cold War bipolarity. As such, this unfortunately means they support autocratic and repressive regimes such as Syria or Iran on the basis of their supposed anti-imperialist stances. We've seen while the uprising in Iran was going on, a letter signed by major socialist figureheads kind of condemning the movement as an American plot to undermine stability in the region. This is really hard for me to read as an Arab socialist when, you know, fellow trade unionists, women activists and students are being killed by these regimes for, you know, redistributive kind of socialist goals, for them to be scapegoated as some kind of imperialist plot. So this kind of completely ignores and kind of replicates the Orientalist lens from an inverse position. It ignores the ideological function of this proclaimed anti-imperialism within the individual countries and the regional imperialist roles of some of them. It's become a very overused term for reactionary forces, especially in Lebanon, because that's where I'm from, and that's kind of the area I cover on, to use this idea of, oh, an American plot to suppress activists in the streets, to justify using force against protesters, which, I mean, it's not something we didn't expect, but when it's being supported by, you know, by international socialist movements, it's a bit difficult to kind of swallow. So it's absolutely necessary that internationally, and especially amongst socialists, it becomes clear that one can fight the enemy at home while also supporting genuine working class opposition to autocratic regimes in the region. That's kind of all I have to say.
Now we have a talk by Rocio Lopez on the US situation. Lopez is a Mexican-American socialist living in the USA, who has also lived in South America and Japan.
Hello, everyone. Let me know if you can hear me so I can move somewhere else with a better connection. So my name is Rocio. I'm from LA. I live in LA in California in the United States. So I'll just start now. So the United States is at the beginning of the end of a 4-year and 2-month nightmare. I guess it's just the beginning, though. It's going to take a lot of work to even undo all the horrible things that happened in the last 4 years, which not all of them can be undone. But so as I mentioned in my bio, I'm a Mexican American, and I just wanted to start this off by saying, when I'm talking about the nightmare, the day after it was announced that Trump won the 2016 election, one of my cousins asked my family if his father would be deported by uncle. And that's what it was like with the start of this nightmare. Fortunately, today, a 100-day moratorium on deportations began. It's not 100%, but it's a welcome development. And the new President Biden put forward a plan to legalize 11 undocumented immigrants. And very importantly, this bill is not tied to any additional immigration enforcement, which this is a massive victory for the immigrant rights movement, especially in the last 2 decades. So I'm going to get into talking about my local left in Los Angeles and California, the Sanders and Warren campaigns. But before then, I want to talk about more national level. I want to emphasize what a massive victory flipping the states of Arizona and Georgia were at the presidential and Senate levels. These victories did not just happen overnight. They were the result of years of grassroots organizing by Black, Latino, Asian, Native American organizers. In the case of Arizona, this was built over the course of a decade. And in Georgia, over the last, since 2018, many, many grassroots movements have built up a fabulous network that enabled these awesome victories. These last 4 years have seen some of the greatest sustained mass mobilizations in the United States since the 1960s and 70s. After Trump won, hundreds of thousands protested that weekend, including me, at the first Women's March on the day after Trump's inauguration in 2017. Millions of people marched against Trump, racism, and et cetera. And then not only, it wasn't just a one-time event. At least 2 more Women's Marches in 2018 and 2019 had 100 possibly millions, but at least hundreds of thousands of people in attendance. In Los Angeles, there were 750,000 people in attendance at the first Women's March. And I believe there were close to a million in Washington, D.C., and they were, like, in every city, and they were really massive. So it's still hard to say exactly how many were there. When the Muslim ban was first announced, hundreds of thousands of people, including myself, showed up at airports, and we just dropped at airports, which is not, if you don't, I don't know how long it's in the United States. That's not something Americans do. We are not the French. We don't tend to do, like, disrupting critical infrastructure like that. The other important events were the Gun Control March for Our Lives in 2018. That was millions of people, too. Almost a million, I think, showed up in Washington, D.C. Obviously, there were the massive protests when the child separation policy of kidnapping children from their parents happened in 2019, I think. Massive nationwide protests happened. Hundreds were arrested trying to stop the Senate hearings of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. And then obviously this summer during a pandemic, hundreds of thousands of people all over the country, over 100 U.S. cities, risked their health for the third Black Lives Matter protest to say enough is enough and face horrific police brutality. So I want to move on to talking about the relation of the left to the Sanders campaign, and also we're talking a little bit about the Warren campaign. But so the Sanders 2016 and 2020 campaigns mainstream social democracy and socialist as an identity in the United States. But the 2020 campaign also showed the limits of a top-down electoral approach to recruiting social democrats and socialists, particularly on a national level. In liberal California, which is two-thirds Democrat, Sanders only won 36% of the primary vote in March. I voted for Elizabeth Warren, who received 13% of the vote. Combined, the social democratic vote in California added up only to 49% of the vote. Sanders actually received fewer votes in California in 2020, 300,000 fewer votes in California in 2020 than in 2016. So this surge that we were assured by his supporters or certain organizations like the Democratic Socialists for America, which is the largest socialist organization in the U.S., they assured us that there would be a massive revolution in surge of voting. That did not happen. Even if you add all the Warren voters to Sanders, like I said, it's not. There was no, it just did not materialize. Even in the stronghold, like California would be where that would happen, did not happen. I should note something that's been misunderstood. I think many people who voted for Biden in the 2020 primary did not do so because they are centrists or even center left, but out of a sense of pragmatism in trying to defeat Trump. That does not necessarily mean that there's a good chunk of Biden voters that do support social democratic policies. In 2020, Los Angeles finally elected its first socialist city council person in many decades. I don't know if we had any in the 30s, but it's been a very long time. And DSALA, is, like I said, Democratic Socialists for America is the largest socialist organization in the U.S. with 75,000 members now and 3,000 in Los Angeles. Other DSA chapters, like in New York and Chicago, have mobilized to recruit candidates and win on the local level in the past, over the last couple of years. But in Los Angeles, it only happened in 2020. In my opinion, because DSALA really neglected to run candidates on the local level. And when they did, they put, you know, kind of half support into it. And they did work on some ballot initiatives, but as far as running candidates, they were far behind other chapters. So yeah, we finally got a socialist city council person in Los Angeles this last November, but DSALA did not run candidates in the most left-wing areas of the city, which are working class, Black and Latino neighborhoods. Yes. Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about the California situation. So in California, we do a lot of ballot initiatives. That's like actually most of what you have to think about when you're voting. Spent a lot of time this year and in 2016 looking over these initiatives. Unfortunately, the progressive economic initiatives did not pass statewide Proposition 15, which would have increased education funding and it would have been a progressive tax reform. Did not pass. I attribute to this to the fact that there was decreased, these ballot initiatives basically have to talk to people face to face, knock door to door, and just, there was not as much of that going on. So that This was did not happen. And then I forget what it was called, but there was a ballot initiative. Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, sponsored. They spent like $100 billion to pass it. Proposition 22 to destroy employee rights. And unfortunately, like I said, that passed. The left opposition could not really put a lot of energy because of COVID into fighting back on the streets and talking door to door. But fortunately, in California, criminal justice reform won restoring the rights of people on parole, people who are been released from jail but are still serving their sentences, was restored. And there was another criminal justice thing that passed. And then in the LA area, we passed the defunding of the police. It did not use those words. It was put in motion before, but it moved part of the discretionary budget of the LA County away from the sheriffs to, you know, social services and prevention. So that was a contradiction that's worth considering of why that happened, why like there was criminal justice reform was popular, like a social thing, but not economic justice. And also, we have a ban on affirmative action in California, and that's also failed. I believe they read the economic ones failed. And I do want to know another victory that I did not mention earlier. So it is important to remember that Republicans had full control of the federal government in the United States for 2 years, Congress and presidency. But because of all this massive resistance I mentioned before, they were actually unable to reach many of their key goals. One being they tried very hard to repeal Obamacare or healthcare reform that happened 10 years ago, and they were unable to succeed. This is something we have to latch on to remind people. We spent all these years on defense, but this was a massive victory. And this was a very important goal to a lot of capital, and they could not get it done. Just barely, but they could do it. And this mass mobilizations that I've talked about translated into electoral victory in 2018, taking back the House. In 2018, the U.S. had the highest midterm turnout ever, I believe. And in 2020, I believe that was the highest turnout since there was, you know, universal suffrage, especially for minorities and women. That was the highest turnout for a presidential election. Actually, one undernoted thing because of all the drama about how long it took to count all the votes. There was a massive increase in Latino voter turnout before. Latino voter turnout was below 50%. I believe in 2016, it's like 49%, I believe. It surged to about 66-67% of eligible Latino voters voted in 2020. And this whole story was overshadowed by the fact that Trump won, you know, more Cuban and Venezuelan votes in Florida, which that was just about red baiting, basically. That was just distinct. He won some votes, you know, along the southern Texas border, which is different because the Latino population in southern Texas has been around before the United States. So it's just these were latched onto, but the key that their Latinos fought back was ignored. Right now, and due to the COVID situation, the U.S., because of all the organizing people have done and the great need, we had interruptions in this, which lasted for many months, which I had to deal with, millions of us had to deal with. But actually, the U.S. has seen the biggest expansion of the welfare state since the 1930s. And this would not be happening unless there was extreme pressure from people, even if it's not so much on the streets. But so this last victory against Trump should be seen as a victory of the working class and minorities and other press groups fighting back and having a coalition. Also, I think a pandemic is having an effect here in the United States. It's really exposed before. It was made very invisible, everywhere, but especially in the U.S. It's very invisible who the critical workers of society are. And now everyone knows who is essential, as we call them, essential workers, who runs society. And I think that's going to give people a sense of like, hey, we make the society work. I think it will lead to a sense of worker empowerment in the long run. Oh, I wanted to briefly mention why I voted for Warren. So Elizabeth Warren won, like I said, 13% of the vote in California, 10% in like other liberal states, large mostly. So she ran an explicitly intersectional campaign, which is why people were like, why isn't everyone voting for Bernie Sanders? So I went to her rally in East Los Angeles at the beginning of March. And she gave a very powerful talk about Los Angeles women, Los Angeles Latina and California workers' history and activist history. And it was very powerful. She hit all the notes. It was like, wow, I can't believe she knows, or at least her speech writers know, and she cares about all these struggles of janitors and local struggles we've had, like immigrants' rights, the long history of immigrants' rights in California. And before I go, I want to talk a little bit about, so I do follow quite a bit of Latin American politics, particularly South America, but recently Argentina had a massive victory for women's rights. They passed legal abortion, which will have a very big ripple effect in the rest of Latin America. It's the first major democracy in Latin America to legalize abortion, and it will not be the last. This also happened because of bastardization. There was mass protests in Argentina in 2018, persisted for 3 years, even during the pandemic, and they forced a reluctant government to make this a priority and pass it. It was inspired by Uruguay, which was a very small country in Uruguay that legalized abortion a few years ago. And this domino will just keep spreading. Chile, after Argentina had their mass protests, Chilean women had their mass protests, and now the Chilean government, or their parliament, whatever it's called, is investigating the prospect of legalizing abortion. So if anybody has questions about the United States or Latin America, I would be happy to answer, because a lot has happened. There have been many major important movements and developments, especially in South America in the last year. Ecuador had anti-austerity protests in 2019. Chile is having a pro-democracy reforms. They're writing a new constitution. There was the anti-Ortega protests in 2018, I think, or 2019, I don't remember what years, but they had those and their vicious reaction to them. So I know a lot about Venezuela. That's a lot. That's probably the biggest sticking point in the U.S. left, is how to deal with that. So if anybody has questions, I would be happy to answer anything, questions you have about Latin America especially. Thank you.